Few musicians have had more influence on modern music than this man, Herbie Hancock. From jazz to R&B to pop music, Hancock has pushed boundaries and definitions in a career that has spanned 5 decades and is still going strong. But if Herbie Hancock has transcended any single musical identity, and he has, the music that has inspired and guided him more than any other is jazz.
It's, in a way, a conversation between the musicians. It's a shared experience. And it's a music that was born from the people. Hmm. There's not a whole lot negative that you could say about jazz.
Herbie Hancock was a child piano prodigy who performed a Mozart piano concerto with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at age 11. But he fell in love with jazz in high school and went on to play with some of the great players, including Donald Byrd, Oliver Nelson, and of course his mentor and biggest influence, Miles Davis. Hancock was part of the second great Miles Davis quintet, along with sax player Wayne Shorter, bassist Ron Carter, and drummer Tony Williams. He writes about this and about the rest of his life in music in his new memoir, Possibilities. And it begins with a wonderful story about playing with Miles Davis in Stockholm in the mid-1960s.
I played this chord that was so wrong. And this was like the best concert of the tour. You know, when everything came together and it was building and building, we had the audience in the palm of our hands.
Right.
You know, and everybody was on the edge of their seats. At the peak of Miles' solo, I go, bling! And I thought I had just brought the whole house down like it was a house of cards. Miles took a breath, and then he played some notes that made my chord right. It made the chord fit. He just found some other way of looking at it, I guess. You know, at the time, I thought it was magic.
Why did you want to start the book with this story?
Because it's a lesson about being judgmental. It's a lesson about respect, trust. Miles was able to hear that chord from another perspective. My tendency was to think at that time that there was only one perspective. Most people think that way. And actually, there's an infinite number of perspectives.
I love the way you expressed it in the book, because you said, as soon as I played that chord, I judged it. In my mind, it was the wrong chord, but Miles never judged it. He just heard it, and he was able to run with it. And what I love about that is it's such a great description of what jazz is, and I'd never thought about jazz as being sort of a great sort of life philosophy.
Philosophically, jazz is very, very humanistic. And I happen to practice Buddhism, which is also talked about a lot in my book. And Buddhism and jazz are really on the same path, same parallel. I mean, they relate to each other so well.
You have, early in the book, a great description of improvisation. I was wondering, can I ask you to read it?
Improvisation, truly being in the moment, means exploring what you don't know. It means going back into that dark room where you don't recognize things. It means operating on the recall part of your brain, sort of muscle memory, and allowing your gut to take precedence over your brain. This is something I still work on every day, learning to get out of my own way. It's not easy, but the times when you can do that are truly magical. Improvising is like opening a wonderful box where everything you take out is always new. You never get bored because what that box contains is different every single time.
So is it still like that for you? I mean, you've been playing for so many years. At one point you say that jazz is something that you can never completely master because it's in the moment. Is that still true for you today? Do you still feel challenged by jazz as something you can never completely master?
Well, every moment is different.
Right.
The idea of jazz, essentially, is being in the moment. So consequently, what comes out can't possibly be exactly the same. Even if you try to copy something you did before, it's a copy. And a copy is not the same as doing something for the first time. I was just thinking about this conversation. We use words that are part of our vocabulary. And so we use certain words over and over again. But the context is not always the same. You know, even if we're talking about the same subject, it's really difficult to say things in exactly the same way that you did at another time, even about the same subject, even about using kind of the same parameters. There's always some differences. So conversation is improvised in pretty much the same way that jazz is.
I want to ask you about some of your music. Now, you released your first album, Taking Off, in 1963, and it included what is still perhaps one of your best-known original tunes, Watermelon Man. And let's just listen to a little.
Chicago, the home of the blues, and rhythm and blues is part of my background. Maybe I can write some kind of funky tune.
That particular song, it's just one of my favorites. And I understand that you had to endure a bit of controversy about it in the choice of subject matter, suggestions that you were playing into stereotypes of black people selling watermelon.
It's kind of difficult to explain here in the 21st century, you know, what the term watermelon meant in the black community back in the early 60s. Even musicians said to me, "You're not going to really call it that, are you?" I said, "Yeah, because is there anything wrong with watermelons?" "No, they're delicious." "Anything wrong with the watermelon man himself?" "Not at all." So I said, "I have to fight for what I believe in."
Well, let me go back a little bit and ask you a little bit about your childhood, which you write about in this book. You write that your family wasn't wealthy. You grew up on the south side of Chicago. And early in the book, you include a description of your neighborhood that your sister wrote for a class. And she describes it as a place where young girls become pregnant, boys become heroin dealers. It was a world of weekend knife fights where the local commerce was heavily weighted toward liquor stores and tawdry five and dimes. But you didn't see your neighborhood that way.
I saw it. I was aware of it.
Yeah.
But I didn't let that occupy my mind. I mean, we had great music in the neighborhood. There was a closeness within the kids. Yeah, we had a few fights and things. But I've always been an optimistic person. That's part of my nature.
Yeah.
And I don't want to change that either.
I want to ask you about Miles Davis, one of your greatest musical mentors. You joined what was called Miles Davis's second great quintet with Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams. And you give so many great examples in the book of times in which Miles would tell you something seemingly small that would have such a big impact in the way the band would play.
Miles didn't talk a lot about music. For example, if we play in a club, very often when Miles is doing his solo, he might turn to face Tony Williams, the drummer, and there would be kind of a dialogue happening there. Or there would be something that Ron Carter, the bass player, was doing, and Miles was responding to that, so he might come get closer to Ron. That got interpreted by critics as Miles turning his back to the audience.
Mm.
No, He was facing the band.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that. I saw him once. I saw him in 1985 in Italy, and he turned his back. And
but who was he facing? Hello? Why? Yeah. Why was he facing the other players rather than facing the audience? You know what the answer is?
Tell me.
To make the music better.
Well, speaking of great music, so in 1965, you released an album on your own called Maiden Voyage, and you've called that title track your favorite of your original tunes.
I got called to do a jingle, and it was for Men's Cologne. So I wrote the song, but they changed the bass line and made it almost like some kind of rumba or something, or tango, or I don't remember exactly what it was. But I thought that the song was worth recording on my own.
Herbie Hancock, I want to jump way farther forward and ask you briefly about your 2005 album, Possibilities. And it featured collaborations with a bunch of contemporary pop singers, everyone from John Mayer to Christina Aguilera to Carlos Santana and Angelique Kidjo. And in fact, Santana and Angelique Kidjo are featured on this song, Safiatu. There was a lot on this album that I just loved, including this song. But what brought you, I don't know, into the world of pop music?
Well, something inside of me had already begun to change. Part of it was due to my practice of Buddhism, too. Mm-hmm. The idea of taking on a challenge, but at the same time, being able to turn poison into medicine. So I started to think, is there another way to look at this? Jazz has always been the kind of music that would lend itself to other genres and borrow from other genres. That's what's kept jazz alive and will continue to keep it alive forever because it's open.
Yeah.
So when it came to doing Possibilities, my task was, how can I kind of demonstrate this kind of openness?
I have to ask you one final question. Speaking of Possibilities, you're still touring heavily. In fact, you're going to be back in Boston in April performing at Symphony Hall with Chick Corea. You've been playing for 60 years, 14 Grammys, an Oscar. What keeps you going? What keeps you excited about playing jazz?
Well, jazz is, I guess, from the whole interview, you can kind of glean that what that excitement comes from. Because it is in the moment, because it is something that you can never master. It is a way for you to express yourself. It's a way to connect with people, heart to heart.
Well, Herbie Hancock, thank you for connecting with us in such a real and fascinating way. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Herbie Hancock's new memoir is called Possibilities. He'll be delivering the memoir keynote at the Boston Book Festival tonight at the Old South Sanctuary in Boston. A lot more information on our website, radioboston.org. And we'll leave you today with the tune Dolphin Dance from Herbie Hancock's 1965 album, Maiden Voyage.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, with a lot of help from Julia Zabo.
And Tim Skog is our technical director. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.